Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 136, which is the second part of our second installment of our series on Burmese amber. In our last episode, 135, we discussed with Naseba Raja and Emma Dunn the political and humanitarian situation in Myanmar, putting the whole conversation about the ethics of trading, collecting, owning, and publishing on this material into context. So if you've not yet listened, that's the place to start. Today, we continue that conversation, asking some of the more difficult questions. Is it ever okay to work with Burmese amber? Can the fossil be viewed separately from the conflict? And what can we as the paleontological community do about any of it? We're offered unique insights, not from personal experiences of the amber mines or of the conflict, but from data scientists looking back at the research outputs of academia. What is the reality of how science is dealing with this ethical minefield? If you enjoy this kind of discussion, then please let us know with your likes, shares, and comments. And an additional thanks to all of those who go the extra mile to support us on Patreon. The first part of our annual address is now available to all of those on Cambrian tiers and above. If you're not yet a member, then now's the time to join. We've got a lecture on Spinosaurids releasing this month, and I think they're quite popular, right? Also, don't forget to visit our website where we have pictures, links, and documents that accompany this episode, and we rejoin the conversation where I'm playing devil's advocate to a commonly expressed opinion. The information in that fossil doesn't depend on anything to do with local geography or nationality or anything like that. That fossil was there 65 million years ago plus. It's got nothing to do with the modern time. The information that's in there, if the best person to describe that is in the US or is in China, shouldn't they be the ones to get that information out of the fossil?
Why does everyone start with this question?
Yeah. I hate it.
Okay, first of all, if we go according to that, there's a lot of things that fall within this category. For example, the Colosseum in Rome that technically wouldn't belong to Italy. For example, or the Stonehenge that, you know, there was no England back in the days. So I don't really know why people bring that up when it comes to fossils. But when someone asks me this question, then I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is why are the best people to describe this fossil not based in the same country where this is found? Because you would assume that, you know, people who would have access to it and who would know more about it would be the people who are close by and not miles away. So this already shows a problem in terms of like the scientific field, where we consider people from certain countries to have expertise about something just because, you know, they have more money and they can access this material more. But also, like, while fossils may be, for example, just scientifically important for certain people, it has cultural value to others. It has another value to other people. And the fact that, you know, people just say, you know, the science is more important, just drives me crazy.
Yep. Echo everything that's just been said. There's so many questions related to that, even a practical sense. How could a fossil, let's say this expert we're speaking of is in the US, how could this fossil make its way to this person without the involvement of any other kind of expert that would at least need to be acknowledged? Like, why are we so individualistic about our way of going on about things and the way we do our research? And the effort of doing that, of getting this fossil across the world, it on a very, very, very basic level, why just leave it to the place that it's been found and leave it to its origin country? And this idea that we must concentrate power in where it's always been and collect all of this paleontological knowledge in like these centers of power and greatness is ridiculous.
And so with these centers of power already established and with these fossils out of the ground already, if they are not bought by paleontologists, by researchers, by people who would be able to describe them, they might fall into the hands of private collectors and be lost to science. So is it better to have these people outside of Myanmar describing the fossils than to have the fossils lost or not even dug up in the first place?
I mean, fossils are lost all the time. If you go on the coast of what is called the Jurassic coast of England or whatever, how many fossils actually lost to erosion on a daily basis? And why do people not talk more about this?
Building work, roads, everything. We lose fossils every single day. But it's not spoken about in the same way, with the same veracity as specimens who might be lost to science that we just have a grasp on.
Mm-hmm. And I also think when it comes to private collectors, the scientific value of the fossil also plays into a role, because if I have something, I want to know what's in it, right? I mean, you can't just say, oh, I have a bug in this amber and it's amazing. And I think they would rely on scientists to be able to get this information, and the scientists in return would get, for example, the publication or, I don't know, exclusive access to it or something like that. But if you remove that middle person, so if you remove that scientist that would be willing to do that for the private collector, this might be a way to actually disencourage. What's the opposite of encourage?
I'm so stumped.
Discourage.
No, that's...
Oh, God. Oh,
well,
God.
Let's just go with disencourage.
No, this might be a way to discourage people from actually buying it. So in a way, scientists are playing a role, paleontologists are playing a role, for first of all, to drive the demand in amber, because they're actually creating a market for amber. But by, for example, associating with private collectors and, you know, like providing services to them, this might also be a way that they are driving this market. Because if you have a bone and you don't know what the bone is, then I don't think, you know, you can show off to your friends, oh, I have, I don't know, T-Rex bone in my cellar or something like that.
That is a lot for me to ingest and come up with something intelligent.
It's a very difficult topic to talk about, in my opinion.
Yeah, and really also to say that we're not the experts in this sense. Like, yeah, we're quite vocal about the research that we're doing, but we're basing this off the data that we're seeing and the stuff that we can read that's available on the internet and available in books and based on other people who've gone before us. But this is a very important issue that requires quite a lot of attention and that we can learn a lot from as paleontologists, but it doesn't quite seem to be getting the attention that it deserves, mainly, I guess, because it's a subject that not many people are comfortable with and that we don't really get taught to be ethical experts and legal experts in a field that actually quite frequently relies on ethics and legal stuff. I think there's a big gap in paleontology education there, that we really should be exposed to these kinds of things quite early on in our careers, or at least be open to learning about them and being uneducated in an area before we go and plow ahead and do something silly. So yeah, hopefully going forward, we'll consider those more in our careers and in our education systems.
Yeah, thinking ahead now, if you're listening to this on YouTube, I will ask the question to save you, and I will do it in your voice. So with you two, you're not
legal experts. You've never been to Myanmar. Why do you have anything to say on this? You're not an expert. You've never been there. And I think that it's important to recognize that you are looking at it from the opposite side, from the side of the science. What's been published? What kinds of patterns are you seeing coming out of the literature? And what does that tell us?
Yeah, absolutely. We're using our own training as the paleobiologists or the quantitative paleobiologists that we are, and that we're using our skills, I guess, in data analysis and data exploration and using the data that is out there to explore and hopefully furthering efforts in that sense. But it doesn't just end with us either. We do need to collaborate with ethical experts, legal experts, and go even further than this.
And this is something that we've actually been trying to do. We've reached out to so many people who actually know more than us on the topics of ethics, on the topics of laws, and we are in close contact with them, and they are the ones that are actually guiding us to know more about this, to learn more about this. And this is why we do need a diverse community in paleontology. This is why maybe, you know, as you said at the start, you know, my background may provide advantages that a traditional paleontology background may not. And we need to encourage more people to turn to paleontology, or to, you know, maybe even just dabble into paleontology, because we need these diverse perspectives in this field.
Yeah, I think this is a good point to shout out to our wonderful co-authors, Paul and Zinn. And Paul is an international law student, and Zinn is actually based in Myanmar. So we've learned tons from them, even in just the short period that we've been working on this project.
Definitely.
Do you feel it's more important to bring in those people that have different experiences to us? I'm talking collectively as paleontology fans, paleontologists, or do you feel that it is more important for us paleontologists to learn something more about the laws and ethics of the fossils of which we study?
Both.
Both.
Yeah, I think it's important that even though we're learning from Paul and Zinn and other people who we've collaborated with, we're not relying on them to do our education. They're not there. They're not paid to educate us. We must take our learning into our own hands and be responsible for that ourselves. But there are so many things like how certain things are done, the cultural sensitivities to certain things as well, that we could never learn from a book or a paper. So I think both are super important.
Definitely.
Okay. So where does it end then? Like, with every fossil that you have in a museum, are you going to have to look at the ethical sourcing of that before you work on it?
Why not?
Yes. Actually, if you do have a museum, then you have to go according to ECOM, which is what the International Commission on Museums, which has a whole section on ethics and how you should treat your specimens and how you should do provenance research. And without that, you can't actually run a museum.
Mm-hmm. These are things that I think people don't realize exist. There are lots of these things as well. There's a code of conduct for conducting research in resource poor countries that all grants that are given by the European Union have to adhere to. Yeah. And yet very few people know about that. There's also a UN convention from 1970 that dictates how cultural property should be crossed between countries or how it should be dealt with within countries. And yeah, I think that goes well under the radar for many people.
Like, actually, the answer to that was yes, you should, because a lot of times you might be legally required to. And in sometimes there are some gray zones, but there are a lot of conventions that countries or museums have signed that they actually should be following.
Yep.
Okay, so if we work on the premise that all of the amber from Myanmar has been, for the most part, exported illegally, or that it's unethical to be working on it, what becomes of the future of say, the mining industry in general and what becomes of the amber as a source of scientific information if, say, all the journals are not willing to accept publications without proof of its ethical sourcing?
I mean, I think as researchers, we can't really change the situation in Myanmar. We have very little power. It's like, you know, recycle your trash and you will help climate change kind of thing, to be honest. But we do play a part into driving the some of the problem that we've highlighted. And the very fact that we can actually do something about this and maybe change it a little bit is something that we should be thinking about. For example, for now, I would say that people should just stop working on it, or at least until, you know, we can, the country, Myanmar, is actually, you know, politically stable again and researchers are able to actually work on this. Reach out to researchers there, to students. There are students who actually I've personally talked to who would love to work on amber, but first of all, the material is very expensive for them to access, and second of all, there's no one to supervise them. So maybe, you know, train students, get into collaborations with universities. There currently is a museum for fossils in Myanmar because there are other fossils found in Myanmar. I think they were primates, for example. So these are in the country. They haven't left the country because of the laws around fossils, which exist since 1957 or something like that. So maybe help them to start curating a collection of amber, show them how maybe these should be preserved, these should be kept, the sort of research that could be done with them. It's about restorating right now. Like, we are too far to actually go back on whatever we've done, but we can give back. We can start a local capacity there in terms of research on amber, if paleontologists really wanted to do that.
Yeah, I think it's all about making space now. We've done the damage, we being resource-rich countries in the global north, let's say. And there's people there who are ready and willing to work on these kinds of things and who lack the resources to do so, that we in our wealthier countries could definitely provide. And the political situation has, in a very horrible way, given time for pause, that we should change what we're doing and how the future of Myanmar amber should be dictated by Myanmar and not everybody outside of Myanmar. And I hope that that's not a very hard thing for people to understand.
You say that.
Yeah.
I can feel my white privileged man rage. Yeah,
you can hear the keyboards clicking already.
Oh, God. Yes. So would you think it's fair, I think, to say, because a lot of people are going to go back to the fact that this fossil has got nothing to do with anything. It's completely innocent in all of this. Would you say that, as kind of a summary of that, that as a researcher, you have to weigh up the ethics of the loss of that fossil and that information versus the ethics and the impact that it would have indirectly on the people who have mined it, of the local people, and you have to balance those two. And in publishing, you are, you know, prioritizing the science over the lives and the impact of the people that dug it up.
Are those two things actually equitable? They're not the same thing, and one of them definitely comes above the other, in my opinion.
I'm going to put things in perspective here, maybe, or try to, rather. In the medical field, a lot of ethics plays a big role in terms of the sort of clinical trials that go through the way that these should be carried out and things like that. And there's a good reason for that. And that's because of the history of medicine, where there were a lot of cases of research that was done that advanced the field, but were horrible in terms of who on whom these experiments were done. For example, for gynecology, for example, a lot of slave women were used as subjects to advance the medical field for the greater good of science and things like that. And I mean, paleontology, we're talking about dead things here, so it's not really the same. But at the same time, when it comes to Myanmar Amber, this has been directly linked to human rights abuses, to human rights violations, to sexual abuse, sexual violence. And the fact that anyone would want to associate themselves with that is outrageous. And the fact that this is not important enough compared to losing one fossil in science is outrageous.
I absolutely agree. And it's a really, really helpful analogy, I think. This that Nasebe is referring to, the reports of the human rights abuses, not to bring the mood down from the positive place we seem to have been going to in the last few minutes, but the UN report on this makes for harrowing reading. Like, the detail that they go into how people have been affected physically, personally, community-wise, from all of this conflict that's been occurring around the amber mines, it's horrific. And I won't be reading that report more times than I need to for my research. But if anybody wants to really read it, it's available freely online for you to read for yourself.
I think we'll actually link to it, because yeah. I think that when people are looking at fossils from Myanmar, they need to have that, have read that report.
True.
It's a long report, but you can just search for Myanmar Amber and you'll get the answers you're looking for.
Okay, so if we draw a line now over all of the amber from Myanmar and say, we are not touching this, we cannot work on this because we cannot separate the collection of this amber from all of the bad stuff that's been going on in there. God, that's a simplification, isn't it? A reduction.
I wish it was that easy.
Yeah. But, okay, we've drawn a line. And is there any way to ethically work on or to own Burmese amber from now? How do we go forwards with this?
So there's a logistical side to this, and then there's the ethical side to this. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking very simplistically here, but my position here is I don't work on Myanmar amber. I am purely looking at it from an outsider's perspective, but with an expert eye on the data and that kind of exploration. The amber that has been taken from the country already is outside the country and probably lacks the documentation that we really, really like to see associated with the material. Ideally, in an ideal world, I'm talking very blue skies, like ideal case scenario here, that material should go back. That's not the country who took it, unless they can prove it is. And I'm sure there's a whole legal situation here that would take years, decades through courts and all that kind of stuff. But again, talking ideal case scenario here, it should go back and it should fill a museum and institutes of education, all of that kind of stuff in Myanmar to allow them to keep their cultural heritage where it was taken from. And then moving forward, we shouldn't collect any new amber or buy any new amber with fossil inclusions for study. Unless it's been done completely ethically, completely legally. But how can we prove that? So the ideal case scenario is quite far from where we're currently at. And it will take a lot of thinking and pondering, a lot of changes of opinions to make this happen. But it doesn't have to be a slow process.
I mean, to start with, stop buying amber. There's a lot of amber everywhere, yeah, in museums, just in, you know, I don't know, basements or in collections or in drawers. Use those to start with, and maybe do the right thing. Send them back when you can. Alert the authorities about,
connect with local researchers. Yeah, connect with people who are in Myanmar and who might want to work on it too, particularly the students.
Do all paleontologists and or institutions and or journals agree with the need for this ethical consideration?
Nope.
What do you think? would there even be a discussion around it if everyone agreed about it?
Yeah. I feel like we're at the place where people seem a little bit more used to the idea that this is a point of discussion, but one of the motivations for us doing this research with data is because we're also at the position where people are like, but I don't believe you, show me the data. Well, now that we have the data coming out to show you, that won't stop the conversation, will it?
So these people that publish on it, they are our colleagues. They are people that we rub shoulders with in conferences. They're people we look up to as researchers.
Not me.
Okay, a lot of this I've been talking devil's advocate. So just posing the question.
No, I do know colleagues who have worked on Myanmar Amber and who have even spoken to me about it, having found out that I was interested in this kind of research. And they, to their credit, are open to learn and to move forward from that past publication that they've done and to see it in a different light and to acknowledge it. Whereas I imagine more people might be more interested in like sliding it under the carpet and pretending it never happened. And I think that only real education can happen when you've been experiencing it somehow. And either that's through like intense research or looking at different patterns for ages and poring over them, or if it's being involved in some way that you mightn't have known exactly what was going on or the circumstances around it, and then realizing, oh, that wasn't exactly the right thing to do, and moving forward and changing your opinion based on that. So yeah, absolutely. Some of these people who work on this are my colleagues, at least, and people who I know well. But I've been fortunate to be surrounded by people who are willing to learn. But there are a lot of people out there who are not willing to move forward.
So my question was going to be, is it up to us to have those difficult discussions with those people who are willing to publish on that kind of stuff? And I guess it's not just Burmese Amber, it's anywhere in the world where laws are being broken. For instance, there's a whole lot of stuff going on with the export of fossils, which is illegal from Brazil, but then people still working on them.
This is actually something that people bring up, like, why focus on Myanmar Amber when there's so many problems around with fossils everywhere? And I think with Myanmar Amber, it's quite a special case study, if we are to call it that. I mean, it's actually like affecting people and everything, but for us, it's right now a case study. Is that it embodies a lot of problems that we see everywhere. And the fact that it's gotten so much media attention means that it is very relevant in certain circles outside of paleontology, which might actually help to make the situation better, or, you know, like, I don't know, force this conversation to go forward, at least. And I think we as paleontologists, and not just us, you know, like even those people who don't want to have these difficult discussions, we should all be involved in this. And this starts with training paleontologists to actually think about these problems, just like we train them in taxonomy, we train them in analyzing data. This is one of the key skills that paleontologists should have. Whether you are just starting out in your career or you are a senior researcher, you should all be having this training. You should all be talking about this, about how you get your fossils, and where do the fossils come from, in what conditions did they come, how you know, how is the local situation there? There are a lot of fossils that come from places that are not politically stable. And how do we, you know, wash our hands off this situation, just focus on the fossil, is unbelievable. So, for example, you have a lot of Chinese fossils in Xinjiang, where the Uyghur people are, and where there are detainment camps at the moment where the Uyghur people are being persecuted. Why do we not talk about this? Why do we not talk about other situations? And that's because we don't know about it as paleontologists. These are problems that are happening around the world, but we are not trained to think about this, these things. And that's why these discussions are really hard to have when you do not even have the knowledge to have a discussion about it. And that's when people get defensive.
Okay, so your study looked at just publications about Myanmar amber. Could you use what you've looked at there and use the methods and apply it to anywhere else in the world? Are you going to go and use this method and look at all the different fossil deposits in anywhere that could be a conflict zone or an ethical quagmire?
I mean, the methods that we've been using are very case specific. In terms of Myanmar amber, the paper that actually will be hopefully out in a couple of months looks at the specifics in terms of economics and politics of Myanmar, of the region, for example. And this might not be applicable to other places. But just looking at publications, for example, is something that we can do for many regions. And but we're not just focusing on the publications themselves. We are trying to link them to different socioeconomic factors. And this is very region specific or country specific. And this is why actually we also have to talk to people from these regions, from these countries, because we don't know what's happening there. And it is only from their insights that we can actually know what's happening. So it's easy to look at the data. It's easy. Like, this is something that I could do very quickly. Like, maybe, you know, I don't know, look at 20 countries or something like that. It's very easy. But to actually put that data in context is really hard. And unless we actually work with people who actually know about these situations, we can't do that.
Yeah. If anybody comes across our paper and thinks that the kind of analysis or data exploration that we did do could be applied to another region, there's of course nothing stopping them from like using the techniques that we use and the same kind of data that we used. But I would implore them to connect with researchers in the region that you're studying in and really dig deep into that contextual information that goes around these data.
Okay, so to conclude then, I guess looking at the wider issues of ethics in paleontology, do you think that the steps that we are making and that you are revealing with this publication that's coming out soon, are we taking the steps towards a better scientific ethical community of researchers in paleontology?
No.
Blunt?
That's brilliant. That can be like the audio advert for this episode. So no, flat no. Why?
Because not the people who are actually involved in those practices that we talk about, I don't think we've reached them yet. I feel right now still we're talking in a bubble where people who agree with us are leading or participating in the conversation. But the very people who actually, you know, I don't know, conducting unethical research, not just with Myanmar amber, with a lot of other fossils, a lot of other objects. I don't think they are part of the conversation yet. And until we reach those people, there's not going to be much progress being made. And in terms of like people who are currently involved in the conversation, they are very much early career researchers like us. And I don't know about Emma, but I feel like because of the issues that we tackle, people might be less reluctant, well, more reluctant rather, to hire us. And maybe the people who are participating in those conversations might not even be here later on to drive progress into paleontology, and you will end up having people who are not interested in these topics being here. So I think it's like there's a lot more to be done for mm-hmm. us to even to say whether we are making progress or not. I don't think we are making any progress. I mean, Emma and I are highlighting issues, but we can't do more than that. We don't have that kind of power.
Yeah, we really lack that structural or systemic power to make changes. Like at the moment, if somebody has a Mimer Amber manuscript and they see that a journal has put a ban on it or whatever, they just move on to the next journal. We're not making any changes that we are making fast enough to make complete community level changes.
I feel in paleontology, relative to the outside world, that there are an awful lot of more considerate people. It's a lot more left-wing, ethically focused than the outside world. So academia is kind of a nice bubble in that way. But yes, there are still people from my generation and newer generations that still have problematic viewpoints. And of course, I'm not immune from that. I'm not trying to get away from that. But my point is, generally, we are a more considerate bunch than maybe some of the older researchers. Would it simply be a case, seeing as we're being so blunt in this conversation, that we've just got to wait for them to die and replace them?
No, I would wholeheartedly say no. I think for me, and I kind of joke about this, that if somebody is absolutely opposed to the ideas that we're exploring and talking about, then at least I know who they are and I can identify them really easily. It's the people who remain silent and who don't engage at all that I find the most difficult to gauge and to see from them than how the change is going to happen, because there's a lot more of them than the very vehemently opposed people.
I mean, they are basically choosing a side by not speaking up. And that's not the side we are on.
Every PaleoCast episode, I've always kind of like left it on some positive, like what's the best thing about what you research? What's the future? Where are we going to take this? And this one has just been kind of everything's awful.
No, absolutely not. The best thing about researching these kinds of topics, and for us personally in our research, has been the amazing, wonderful, extraordinary people that we've been able to connect with. And actually, I don't think a lot of this research would have happened in the same way it did had it not been for the pandemic as well, because we cold emailed a lot of people. We dipped into people's DMs. You know, we just got talking to as many people as we possibly could. And we learned so much and have made so many connections with people from all across the world that we probably wouldn't have been brave enough to had we not been in a position where we couldn't do anything but.
It's incredible. Yeah,
we really lucked out with the people we got connected with over this project and the wider project that we've been publishing on since it started. And I'm just completely amazed with how much I've learned from these people and how gracious they've been with their time and expertise. So I would recommend for everybody to go out there.
Also how ready they were to jump on the projects and to participate.
And just how much enthusiasm they had. When we were at the point where nobody's going to listen to us or we're doing this for no reason, they would just come out of the woodwork and be like, oh, this is so cool. Yeah, totally. I'd love to get involved. And you're like, oh my God, yes. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so the positives of the potential of international collaboration is somewhere where we can
absolutely.
Leave
go
it
out there,
on a positive.
Connect as many people as you can and make friends.
Definitely.
But still, there's so much work to be done. So thank you for coming on the show and talking us through what has been quite a roller coaster of... ethical considerations and
thank you so much for platforming this discussion and for inviting us to be part of it, and we hope that it encourages even more conversation.
Definitely. And I just want to say, paleontologists, you can do better.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.